You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, what are the odds that a space rock will strike the Earth and bring about widespread devastation in an asteroid apocalypse?
What happened perhaps should be a wake-up call to the planet. You know, we're not monitoring enough of the sky. We need complete coverage. We're not doing enough.
Is the universe unstable and in danger of vanishing and being replaced by another in a Higgs boson-induced apocalypse?
Once this bubble forms, there's no stopping it. It will expand to fill the entire universe. You won't have any warning. You won't notice it. It's coming at you at the speed of light. It will leave behind a new universe, which, who knows, might be better than the one we're living in.
Physicists say, let there be light. And it is, as they produce real photons in the lab out of the empty vacuum. Is this a sign of the apocalypse?
So it is, in some sense, paradoxical. By doing something from outside, you transform the virtual particles into real particles.
And are quantum effects helping plants carry out photosynthesis more efficiently, providing them with the energy to take over the world in a botanical apocalypse?
They saw that actually energy doesn't really just sort of like hop from molecule to molecule. It actually spreads in what we would call a coherence or a wave-like manner. So evolving according to the laws of quantum mechanics.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali.
Welcome to the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute, which for this edition, we're rebranding as The News of the End of the World.
Or Doomsday Monthly.
Okay, we have to admit that the menu at the top of the show is perhaps a little bit sensational.
Just a tiny bit. We apologize for scaring listeners, but in fact, only the first two items are about potentially devastating effects via asteroid impact or due to an unstable universe. The final two items don't have anything at all to do with the end of human civilization, at least as far as we know. So please don't start panicking and building bunkers yet. Our final two segments are really about experiments to create light from the vacuum using the Casimir effect, and how plants may be harnessing quantum effects in order to convert sunlight to energy efficiently.
All joking aside, we really couldn't ignore the very serious news that a couple of weeks ago, a meteor struck the Russian city of Chelyabinsk, injuring over 1,000 people and causing over $30 million worth of damage. We wish well to all those affected.
The news was even more startling because on the same day, February 15th, the asteroid 2012 DA14 came within 27,700 kilometers of the Earth, a distance that is closer than the orbits of Earth's geosynchronous satellites. The asteroid pass has been predicted, but the meteor strike, which was unrelated to it, was totally unexpected. Two physicists in Colombia have tracked the meteor's origin and calculated that it was most likely one of a family of so-called Apollo asteroids that come from the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter and whose orbits often cross Earth's orbit. A link to their paper is on our website, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
The meteor and asteroid events, coming on the same day, have raised worries about how we monitor the threat from space rocks. In the movie Armageddon, Bruce Willis famously played an astronaut who saved the world at the last minute by flying out to an asteroid and blowing it up. But in reality, what options do we have for dealing with incoming asteroids if we do manage to spot them? Earlier, I put that question and others to astronomer Edwin Bergen at the University of Michigan, who began by telling me more about the origins of asteroids and meteors.
In the solar system, most of the smaller rocks that are found exist in the asteroid belt. Bodies, you know, meters to kilometers in size, that exist in orbit around the sun between Mars and Jupiter. And in general, asteroids are just the flotsam and jetsam left over from the birth of planets. And then through interactions with Jupiter, some of these rocks get thrown on different orbits, and some of those orbits actually intersect with the Earth. And so the ones that actually make it down to the surface of our planet, we call meteorites. And when they come in the sky, they're called meteors. And the ones that just float right by us, we still call them asteroids.
We saw something that seemed incredibly unlikely a couple of weeks ago, where we had two events, which I guess were unrelated, happening on the same day. So can you talk a bit about the odds of either of these events occurring, let alone them both occurring at the same time?
Yeah, so based upon estimates of the size of the asteroid in Russia, those type of objects hit the Earth about once every 100 years. So the odds of that happening at any given time are low, but, you know, over 100 years, it should happen at least once. In terms of asteroids coming as close as that one to the Earth, I'm not certain what the statistics are myself, but it's not very high. Certainly would be at least equivalent to what we saw with the one in 100-year meteor hitting Russia, probably less likely. And so for them both happening at the same time, it's very, very unlikely. But the Earth has been around for a very long time, and these events will happen. There's lots of things floating in space, and every once in a while, they do come by us. And every once in a while, they come by us in groups.
What do people currently do? What are scientists doing at the moment to monitor any potential risks from such objects?
What we're worried about is the bigger rocks. So the rocks that are, you know, kilometers in size, and if they were to reach the surface of the Earth, they could cause massive devastation. So you think about what happened to the dinosaurs when a very large rock hit the Earth, and it had a significant impact on the dinosaur extinction. We think it was one of the precipitating causes of that extinction event. So we're worried about that because it would be very devastating to the habitability of our planet. It may not be devastating in terms of wiping everything out, but on the other hand, if a large rock fell on one of the major cities, it would have thousands, tens of thousands of worth of essentially TNT equivalent to a nuclear bomb. So we're looking for the big ones. And for the most part, the big ones are easier to find than the rock that hit Russia. That was about 50 meters in size, maybe 30 meters in size. We would love to search for these smaller rocks as well. But to find them, you need to have greater sky monitoring than what we have right now, and probably bigger telescopes as well. And all this costs money. So what we do is we have our telescopes, and they scan the sky repeatedly and look for objects that move with respect to the background field of stars. So stars are so far away that they effectively don't move relative to one another. And any object that we see that does move, we know that it's something in the local solar system. So we monitor the sky, but we have to pay. Somebody has to pay for these telescopes to do this. Somebody has to pay for astronomers to take the data, store the data, analyze the data. And right now, NASA has some efforts directed towards this, but this is a planet-wide problem. It's not a United States-wide problem. And so there have to be more directed efforts. And so I think, you know, what happened recently perhaps should be a wake-up call to the planet that this is an issue that we all should be taking part in and collectively working our efforts together to try and at least make sure that if we get about 10 years warning, that should be enough for us to react and deter an object that could wreak greater devastation.
A question that's been coming up a lot since this has happened, and certainly on our site and amongst our listeners, we've had questions in asking, if we do detect the chance that something's going to happen, and you gave a kind of a 10-year warning time frame there, what could we do about it? Is there anything we could do about it? And I guess as one of our readers asked, can we do anything other than just hurl Bruce Willis in the sky at them?
Yeah, well, Bruce Willis isn't going to work on this one. The longer amount of time that you have, the greater ability you have to do small effects on the asteroid that can alter its orbit just slightly such that it would miss the Earth. So if you can go to the asteroid within, you know, a year or two and, say, shoot something at it. So, for example, we had a mission called Deep Impact where we shot something, you know, the size of about a VW bus at a comet to try and expose some of the deeper layers to study, you know, what's deep inside comets, because usually all we see is the surface of the comet as it's evaporating when it goes by the sun. And if you can get deeper down, you may get to some original materials. And so we were able to do that. It was a tremendous success. So we know how to do things like that. And so if you can go up to a comet or an asteroid and shoot something at it, you could perturb its orbit slightly. other ideas that people have is to put rockets in orbit around the comet, and they have a little bit of thrust such that it doesn't escape orbit from the asteroid, but it actually tugs at the asteroid. And just little tiny tugs over time can alter the orbit just a tiny little bit so that it would pass by us just like that other asteroid did a week or two ago.
And so that's, you know, the sort of things we could do if we had a few years to prepare. But with the current monitoring situation, I guess the worry is there any chance that a big asteroid could sneak up on us in the way that the Russian meteor, that was much smaller, sort of caught us all by surprise?
You know, I would say yes.
Yes. Yeah.
We're in trouble, right? You know, we're not monitoring enough of the sky. We need complete coverage. We're not doing enough. And what we saw was random crap falling from the sky, right? And so that tells you that randomness happens. And so, you know, you ask the dinosaurs, right? They looked up and said, oh my God, right? So, hey, we can do better.
Thank you to Edwin Bergen from the University of Michigan, who unfortunately failed to reassure me that we are not all going to die. We also have a blog post up by FQXI member and astronomer Fred Adams, also at the University of Michigan, who has calculated the odds of impacts by various sized space rocks for us on the website www.fqxi.org/community.
So they're both at the University of Michigan. What does Michigan know that the rest of us don't? That's what I want to know.
I think there are more important things to be worrying about than that, Brendan.
What's more important than a Michigan-based conspiracy involving death from space rocks?
How about death by the Higgs?
We're being attacked by the Higgs boson now. Why did we let those crazy scientists at the LHC make them in the first place?
It's even worse than that. Depending on the measured properties of the Higgs, such as the values of its mass, our universe may or may not be stable. If it's unstable, there's a chance that it will be replaced by a more stable universe, wiping us all out in the process.
Oh dear.
Oh dear indeed. Particle physicist Joseph Licken of Fermilab carried out preliminary calculations based on the data about the Higgs that we've got so far from the LHC, which is now temporarily shut down. And the news, as he announced at the AAAS meeting in Boston in February, is not good.
My name is Joe Licken. I'm a particle theorist at Fermilab, and I do theory research, usually on the Higgs boson. We believe that there is an energy field that's everywhere that you can't see, that's invisible, called the Higgs field. And we believe it's that energy field that gives other particles mass. So since it's invisible, it's kind of hard for us to do experiments on it. But we know from quantum mechanics that if you have an energy field, it should, at a subatomic level, it should be quantized. You should be able to kick out a particle from that energy field. This is the same thing we do with electricity and magnetism when we produce photons, which are little bundles of electromagnetic energy. So we were trying to do this with the Higgs energy field for a long, long time. We finally succeeded last year in doing it at the Large Hadron Collider. So we're making Higgs bosons, which are particles, and they're made out of this energy field that we believe exists everywhere.
And so if this field kind of changes its properties or changes its values suddenly, it could make the vacuum unstable. Is that the idea?
That's right.
It could actually make empty space could be unstable.
That's right. The empty space that exists out there in the whole universe could be unstable. And what I mean by that is it's just a question of energy. If for some reason there's a lower energy state than the vacuum that we live in, then eventually the universe will try to get into that lower energy state. And it could happen spontaneously just through what we call a quantum fluctuation somewhere out in some distant galaxy. But once that happens anywhere, it will then be energetically favorable for that little bubble of the better vacuum, of the low energy vacuum, to keep expanding at the speed of light until it fills up the whole universe.
And so how can you have a vacuum that is at a lower energy state? Because I guess when we talk about the vacuum, we usually think about it being empty. We usually think about it as being sort of the least interesting kind of configuration of anything, that there isn't anything sort of more basic or with less energy than the vacuum that we usually talk about. So how can we talk about another region of vacuum that's kind of even more of a vacuum?
Yes, this has to do with one of the big conceptual changes that's happened in the modern times, which is the realization that the vacuum isn't empty. If the vacuum were really empty, then this question I'm talking about wouldn't really mean anything. But the vacuum isn't empty. In particular, it has these energy fields in it, and they're interacting with each other in a complicated way. So there's actually a complicated physics question. There's a bunch of related things that you have to understand at a subatomic level in order to understand what the properties of your vacuum are and whether or not there's another vacuum that we want to get into.
And so you mentioned that this more stable vacuum could appear somewhere else. It could appear in another galaxy or another part of the universe. But if that does happen, it's going to be bad news for the rest of the universe. So can you sort of describe what exactly would happen? Would this sort of this bubble just kind of grow outwards and just kind of kill us all? Would we notice it? Would it happen so quickly that we wouldn't even notice anything? We'd just be dead? You know, what would we see in that case?
Yeah, so the bad news is once this bubble forms of a particular type and a particular size, there's no stopping it. It will expand to fill the entire universe. But there's several pieces of good news. One is that it's very difficult to make this bubble. There's an energy barrier between us and the other vacuum, even if there is another vacuum that we want to get into. And that's why it won't happen for billions of years, because it's a very unlikely sort of thing to happen. Another piece of good news is you won't have any warning. You won't notice it. It's coming at you at the speed of light. And so you might as well not even worry about it, because we'll have no idea that it's even happened. It will leave behind a new universe, which, who knows, might be better than the one we're living in. From the calculations we're doing now, it doesn't actually seem to be the case. It looks like the new universe will be more boring than the one we live in. But maybe those calculations are wrong. This is all preliminary stuff.
So let's talk about those calculations. What exactly are you looking into, and how does it relate to the properties of the Higgs boson that have been measured so far at the LHC?
Yes, so some of my colleagues set up these calculations many years ago, and they're quite complicated because the Higgs, of course, talks to all the other elementary particles in order to give them mass. So this calculation involves not just the Higgs boson, but the properties of all the other elementary particles and forces that we know about. So it's quite a challenging computation. But my very smart and dedicated colleagues have set this up over the years, and all they were missing was one number, and that number was, what is the mass of the Higgs boson? And you can't complete this calculation until you know that number. Well, since last year, we actually know that number. It's 126 GeV in the units that we use. And so we can do the calculation. And what's really fascinating is that we find out not only that our vacuum is unstable, but that we're right on the edge of instability. That if the Higgs boson mass had turned out to be even a few percent heavier, we would be living in a stable universe instead of an unstable universe.
Okay, so I guess that calculation has been done. So there's no hope that further sort of future runs at the LHC might refine our understanding of the Higgs, and maybe we'll find ourselves actually in the stable region. It's just, you know, just that's it. We're in this sort of unstable area.
Well, when I say it's preliminary, it's not because we don't know how to do the calculation, but the calculation is very sensitive to the values of certain parameters like the mass of the Higgs boson. So we do need to measure those more accurately. It also depends on whether there are other kinds of particles around that we need to include in the calculation. So for example, one thing that I'm looking at now with my collaborators is what happens with dark matter. Dark matter exists, we think, and we think it's made of particles. And the calculation I'm talking about does not take dark matter into account because we don't really know how to do that yet. So that's a big caveat, is it might be that in the end, dark matter might save us from this fate.
Okay, so what next now? Are you just going to have to wait for the LHC, which I think has sort of stopped running at the moment, to start running again to collect new data?
Yes, I think we're in a period now where we're waiting for the new data, and it's a time for us that do theory to think about what are the consequences of what we've already learned. So this is an example, this vacuum stability, of a theoretical idea that was around for a long time. But now, by putting in the data, we find out that it's really a much more interesting question than we had thought, that we're actually right on the edge of stability for some reason that we haven't explained. So I think there are a lot of big questions like that we're going to be thinking about for the next couple of years, and it gives us plenty to do while we're waiting for the new data.
Do we have any idea why the universe would be in this particular configuration, rather than having started out in the more stable kind of vacuum in the first place? Is it just something to do with chance? Is it something particular to do with the way the Higgs had to be? Could it have been another way?
That's a very good question, and it's another thing that a lot of people are working on right now, which is what happens when you wind the clock backwards of the Big Bang and you ask what was happening with the Higgs boson in the very early moments of the Big Bang. It was a different situation from what we have now because it wasn't just the vacuum like we have it now. The universe was very hot, and a very hot universe is a different kind of physical system than the cold universe we see now. So the Higgs boson may have been doing very different things in the early universe, which might explain how we ended up in the wrong vacuum, but that's something we're trying to investigate now, and it involves everything we know about cosmology in a way that's really very challenging for us theorists.
That was Joseph Licken talking to Zia.
And he also failed to reassure me that we're not all going to die.
Although I do question your decision to run the asteroid story before the unstable universe story. Surely the entire universe being destroyed is far more dramatic and of wider interest, in fact, of universal interest, you might say, compared to a local news story about the possibility of human life being wiped out only within our solar system. I think it was a little parochial to prioritize Earth over the rest of the universe.
I take your point, Brendan, I do, and I did debate it, but in the end I decided that since most of our listeners are based on Earth, at least according to our podcast statistics, I should think first about what they would most be interested in.
But those podcast stats could include alien intelligences that listen to our podcast on Earth, though. Did you think about them? Personally, I think some of FQXI's own members are extraterrestrials.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to accidentally alienate any of our alien listeners. If you are an alien, let me stress we would love to hear from you. You can contact us by email at podcast@fqxi.org or follow us on Twitter at FQXI.
Human listeners are also welcome to contact us by these same means. Now, back to the whole unstable universe idea just described. That basically came down to the quantum idea that empty space, or the vacuum, is not all that empty. Instead, virtual particles are always popping out of it in pairs and then recombining again and disappearing. These virtual particles can't usually turn into real particles that can exist by themselves for long periods of time. But in 1948, Dutch physicist Hendrik Casimir realized that before they vanish, virtual particles can produce observable effects. For instance, when two mirrors are placed facing each other in a vacuum, if more virtual photons gather on the outside of the mirrors than between them, the mirrors will be pushed together. This is called the Casimir effect. Zia, you've been chatting with FQXI member Soren Peruanu, a physicist at Aalto University in Finland, about this, haven't you?
Yes, that's right. His team has just published a paper in PNAS describing experiments in which they used an array of superconducting quantum interference devices, SQUIDs for short, to create the so-called dynamical Casimir effect, producing real photons of light from the quantum vacuum. Their experiments could also be used to test some theories about the working of black holes. In particular, in the 1970s, Stephen Hawking predicted that black holes radiate particles. That process comes about because if a pair of virtual particles is produced just outside a black hole's boundary or its event horizon, then the black hole can sometimes swallow one of the virtual partners before the pair has a chance to recombine. In that case, the abandoned virtual particle becomes a real particle.
Like Pinocchio becoming a real boy.
Yes, exactly like that. But if, you know, Pinocchio was a virtual quantum particle rather than a wooden puppet. Anyway, Peruanu told me all about the team's experiments and how they can be used to model black holes in the lab. He began by explaining how virtual particles give rise to the dynamical Casimir effect.
The idea of the effect is that there is vacuum. And vacuum in quantum physics is not really empty, but you can imagine it as a kind of boiling liquid in which there are virtual particles popping in and out of existence. So there are particles that are all the time being created and annihilated in pairs. So the virtual particles, they have a very short finite lifetime. So they go a bit farther apart from each other, but then they come back and they annihilate, they transform back into the vacuum state. So overall, if you look at the vacuum, there is nothing really there. But then what we are doing is that we act faster than this recombination lifetime of the particles. In other words, if you do something on a time scale which is faster than the recombination time of these particles, so that you catch them in the act of being separated, if you want, then you transform these virtual particles, you really transform them into real particles, and then you see them as a pair of real photons.
So you're basically creating light from nothing then. So light is appearing where you would have expected an empty vacuum inside a box.
Yeah. Also, let's just remind this that these are microwave photons. They're not optical photons. Just imagine that you have a box, just an ordinary box, and it's closed. And there is nothing inside. There is no light inside. There are no photons inside. But then you suddenly change the boundary conditions. That is, you change, for instance, you move one of the walls of the cavity of the box. Then the theoretical prediction is that there will be photons, real photons, created from vacuum, from these virtual excitations that are populating the vacuum. In other words, by doing something from outside, you transform the virtual particles into real particles. So it is in some sense paradoxical, because classically you cannot understand this effect. You cannot have a state in which there is no particle, and then you create these particles just by changing the enclosure of that state, to put it like this. It's a pure quantum mechanical effect.
This was predicted in 1948. You know, it sounds like such a strange, bizarre effect. What other experimental evidence has there been for this already?
For quite a long time, there was no experiment, because if you take the numbers needed to see any effects, and I mean, if you take the equations and you plug in the numbers, the results is stunningly low. So people have thought about how to make some experiment that changes boundary conditions fast enough, but it's not possible with mechanical means. You cannot move things that are massive like mirrors too fast. And then there was the idea that one could use superconducting circuits. And one experiment in this direction was done by a group in Sweden about 1 year ago, about at the same time as with us. Effectively, they have created a situation that can be understood as a mirror that is moved in space. In our case, it's more like we are changing the index of refraction of what we call a Josephson metamaterial.
So you used the word there, metamaterial, and I think I've heard this word before. I guess there was a lot of excitement about metamaterials over the past few years, because people have been using them to make things like invisibility cloaks that can hide objects by channeling light around them. So can you explain what a metamaterial is? And I guess, as you say, what's important about a metamaterial is the ability to change the index of refraction. So what does that mean?
Yeah, generally, a metamaterial is a material whose properties do not depend on the chemical composition. They emerge rather from the structure. With a metamaterial, you can arrange the index of refraction to be either positive, negative, or whatever you want. And that comes from structure, from creating the structure with which the light interacts in a quite peculiar way. In our case, we have what we call a squid array. Technically, it's an array of superconducting quantum interfering devices that is embedded in a transmission line. So this creates a structure that is characterized by the index of refraction. We can control externally, that's the important point, that we can control externally this index of refraction, and we can do this very fast. Exactly the frequencies required to see this effect.
So I guess in your experiment, you haven't moved the walls of a box, but you've been changing the refractive index very quickly to have a similar sort of effect of changing the environment in which these virtual photons are produced. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So changing the index of refraction of this material is somewhat equivalent to changing the boundaries. Because what we are changing is in which way the modes of the electromagnetic field would fit in the cavity. So we are changing what is called the effective electrical length of the cavity. It's mathematically, it's equivalent to changing the length of the cavity.
And so you've got your cavity and you are manipulating the index of refraction. How do you know that the experiment has worked? So how can you tell, first of all, whether or not they're virtual photons there? And how can you tell that they've turned into real photons?
Okay, so there's quite a lot of many checks that we have done. Essential point maybe is that our material is cooled below 50 millikelvin. So we are certain that the state that is there is vacuum. There is no photon present in the experiment, during the experiment. Mm-hmm. And then we just change the index of refraction, and then we watch to see if something comes out. And this watching is not that simple. It is an entire experimental setup that consists of circulators, amplifiers, and so on and so on. But in the end, whatever is generated there comes through this measurement system at room temperature where it's detected. So what we see is that when we change the index of refraction, we see that photons are emerging out of this cavity. And we know that they are emerging in pairs as predicted by the theory. So it's exactly this process by which virtual photons that they are in pairs are transformed into real photons and then they are detected.
This is a lovely demonstration of this very strange quantum effect that was predicted a long time ago. But are there any applications of this type of experiment or this type of work for other purposes?
Yeah, we are thinking about how to develop this type of experiments next. I think one important direction is to look at what we call analogs of the Hawking effect.
So these kinds of experiments also have applications to doing tests of theories in cosmology, for example, about black holes, which are very, very difficult to test practically in any other way. They're things that astronomers have a lot of difficulty observing because obviously black holes are very hard to study. But there are these theoretical effects that Stephen Hawking predicted about radiation that can come out of black holes that is itself related to the idea of the vacuum and particles coming in and out of the vacuum.
Hawking effect is another effect which is related to the dynamical Casimir effect. In the Hawking effect, you have pair anti-pair production of particles at the event horizon, and one particle falls inside the black hole, the other one is emitted as the Hawking radiation. So it's essentially mathematically the same process and is responsible for both dynamical Casimir effect and Hawking radiation. So we're thinking how, if it's experimentally possible to make an analog of the Hawking effect, that would be quite interesting, I believe. The general goal for us is to create a setup in which we can reproduce some of these predictions coming from gravitation cosmology, perhaps even some theories of quantum gravity, using superconducting circuits. So as long as we map correctly the physics, then we believe that we can basically reproduce the basic predictions and the fundamental phenomenon in this kind of, say, tabletop experiments.
Thank you to Soren Peruanu there for not telling Zia that the world is about to come to an end.
Yes, that was a much jollier item there about making light.
Ah, light, the ultimate source of all our energy. Which brings us to our last item about photosynthesis, the process through which plants convert light to energy. Reporter Karin Pikama met up with quantum physicist Alex Chin at the University of Cambridge in the UK, who described growing evidence that photosynthesis may have quantum roots. Quantum roots. That's funny.
So my name is Dr. Alex Chin. I'm a Winton Advanced Research Fellow at the University of Cambridge. And for the last few years, I've been working on the quantum mechanics that may be involved in photosynthesis.
Chin is one of a group of researchers working on the frontiers of the emerging field called quantum biology. Quantum biology investigates exotic quantum properties in biological systems. One of the most promising areas in this field of research is photosynthesis. This is the process that helps green plants, algae, and even certain bacteria to grow. Through a chemical reaction evoked by sunlight, carbon dioxide and water are transformed into plant material. This process is incredibly efficient and doesn't cost the plant a huge amount of energy. In 2007, Greg Engels and his colleagues in the research group of Graham Fleming at the University of California, Berkeley, first showed that photosynthesis might actually depend on the quantum property of superposition. This is the idea that particles can be in more than one place, or indeed in more than one state at the same time. Since this discovery, several other research groups have become interested in the potential quantum mechanical properties of photosynthesis. But most of the research in this area to date has focused on proving that photosynthesis is indeed making clever use of superposition. Jin and his collaborators across Europe have now actually started thinking about how plants are achieving these quantum states. But before we delve into how plants perform quantum mechanics, let's take a closer look at the two processes at work in photosynthesis.
There are the light reactions, which is the part where solar energy is captured, converted into essentially sort of molecular excitations, and then used to produce electrons. And then there are sort of the dark reactions, where those sort of electrons go on to participate in sort of chemistry, drive a sort of synthetic chemistry that ultimately fixes carbon. All of the recent work and the interest that this would be properly put into the category of quantum biology, well, looks at the light reactions. So all of the things that happen when photons are absorbed, typically in molecules like chlorophyll, they tend to sort of excite electrons in those molecules. So the molecules are sort of excited, that they actually have a sort of different electronic configuration, and that configuration can be sort of passed around from molecule to molecule, typically through what are known as pigment protein complexes, down to another type of structure called a reaction center, where that energy is used to release an electron. And that process, particularly under conditions of low light intensity, can be extremely efficient. Often for one photon absorbed, an electron almost always comes out. It's close to 100% efficient in that sense.
So even in the deepest corners of our oceans, where sunlight is scarce, algae still manage to perform photosynthesis. But quite how this amazing sensitivity is actually achieved, for a long time remained hidden behind our technological limitations. That's because, while my or Chin's explanation of photosynthesis may take some time, the process itself is quite astonishingly rapid. It takes place in the pico and femtoseconds. That's a millionth of 1 billionth of a second. And up until recently, we had simply no means of observing events over such a brief period of time.
What challenged our idea about that sort of process was the development of extremely fast and very precise optics that could really start to probe in detail what was really happening on these very, very fast timescales. So as I said, femtoseconds, picoseconds, and particularly in some of the structures from the green sulfur bacteria, that was the first example of where we were able to really sort of see this energy transfer following light absorption. And when people were able to then actually sort of zone in on what was happening in these very tiny time windows, they saw that actually energy doesn't really just sort of like hop from molecule to molecule. It actually spreads in what we would call a coherent or a wave-like manner, so evolving according to the laws of quantum mechanics.
The super-fast lasers the researchers used allowed them to spot a periodic or oscillatory pattern in the travelling energy. The oscillations, or quantum beats, are the signature of quantum coherence.
Under this wave-like evolution, it's really the way energy moves. It's not localized on any particular molecule, moving from molecule to molecule, but delocalized over many molecules. And according to the laws of quantum mechanics, it essentially explores all the different pathways simultaneously before alighting on the center. And that's thought still in some sense a conjecture, but there seems to be mounting evidence for it, to be an important way in which, or an important mechanism by which energy is delivered quickly and efficiently towards the reaction center.
Thus, photosynthesis established itself as a potentially quantum process. This was surprising, as until recently it seemed extremely unlikely that quantum properties would be found in nature. So far, scientists' best results in creating quantum states artificially have been achieved with temperatures that we normally only see in deep space. One of the main reasons that physicists try to do this is to eventually build a quantum computer, a device that in theory could carry out certain tasks far faster than any existing computer.
There's a great deal of interest in harnessing quantum effects for technological purposes, or most famously the quantum computer. You know, a great challenge there is actually trying to ensure that quantum effects survive long enough that we're able to do useful things with them. And so for me personally, one of the most interesting things here was the idea that there's something going on in these molecules that actually allows these quantum effects to last over the typical time periods where it's actually doing something useful. There is a certain type of management or architecture in these structures which actually allows those effects to persist on longer timescales than we might expect. And that might provide some conceptual ideas or design principles.
So the fascinating question is now how it is possible that in the messy environment in which plants operate, these quantum states can exist and even persist for long enough to be useful.
The important thing is understanding how the particles carrying the energy, which are called excitons in this case, interact with their environment, which in these systems are the molecules that support these excitons and the proteins that surround them. Now, the proteins around them are in sort of constant thermal motion. They constitute a type of noise which will disrupt coherence of energy. And that was ultimately thought to be the reason why we wouldn't expect there to be much coherence in these things, particularly at room temperature where they're really jiggling around like crazy. However, what we became interested in was the idea that there can actually be particular types of vibration in these complexes, which are very strongly connected or coupled to the exciton motion, which rather than destroy exciton coherence, they can actually preserve or even generate it. And essentially what can happen is that the excitons move through this system as waves, and vibrations are types of wave themselves. So some of the wave-like character from the excitons can be transferred out into these very particular vibrations. But because these vibrations are less subject to the sort of random noise that's everywhere, they can transfer that coherence back into the excitons at a later time and effectively prolong the coherence lifetime of those excitons against this very noisy background. And that seemed to, once we built that into our model and put that into our simulations, turned out a set of typical times in which the excitons behave like waves, which was consistent with the experimental results. So there's a very, very intricate set of interactions between the exciton and its environment that actually allows these quantum effects to last longer than we might think otherwise.
This new model, which was published in Nature Physics at the start of 2013, gives a tantalizing explanation for how photosynthesis might be quantum. Although there is still a lot to be explored, Chin's research may turn out to be an important step towards our ability to harnessing exotic quantum principles. Ultimately, the more we can learn about how nature manages its quantum mechanical tricks, the closer technological dreams such as quantum computing might come to reality. And Chin thinks that quantum biology may end up having a much wider reach.
There is great interest in this field, and I think that will encourage people to look further and deeper into other types of biological process. A little closer scrutiny might well actually turn up more quantum effects.
Thank you to Alex Chin, who is speaking to Corinne Pikema. I'm glad we've moved fully away from the doom and gloom set up in the earlier part of the podcast, with all that talk about meteor impacts.
Although, I did read a terrifying physics paper that suggested that following a meteor shower, certain giant plants can develop intelligence and will roam around blinding and killing people.
Oh, yeah.
And even feeding off them.
That wasn't a physics paper. That was John Wyndham's post-apocalyptic novel, The Day of the Triffids. Or else it was an episode of Doctor Who.
I think you might be right now that you mention it. Anyway, there's more information about quantum biology in an article on the website, www.fqxi.org/community. And you can hear interviews about how quantum effects could help birds navigate and explain the mechanism behind our sense of smell on previous podcasts, which you can find on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
That's all we had time for, so thank you again to Edwin Bergen, Joseph Licken, Soren Parawanu, Alex Chin and Karin Pikama.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.